This week, we dive into part two of Max Hindel's Ancient and Modern Initiation, as we talk about the Annunciation and Immaculate Conception. Are the terms Immaculate Conception and Annunciation misrepresented in Scripture today? Is a tecton more than a builder? Then, we'll hear from illustrious Brother Harrison in an all-new Masonic Minute, a new school, a picked-out name, an abandonment of that name because, well, he was a Freemason, and ultimately the school was named after somebody else. But there's a catch. What was it? You'll have to stay tuned to hear more. We'll wrap it up with a profile in courage. A recent article by illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison about the actions of a U.S. president, a brother who made one of the toughest calls in his life. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 485. It's hard to believe that in just 15 weeks we'll hit episode number 500. How have we gotten this far? Well, we would not have gotten this far at all without the help of our supporters. Whether you're a contributor, a fellow, a producer, or a legacy partner, you have brought this program to the world since July of 2011. Almost 10 years. If you want to know more about how you can assist this program, you can check us out at the Support the Show link at the top of the webpage, wcypodcast.com. You can be a contributor, a fellow, a producer, and that is available to you through Patreon or PayPal. There are a number of little bonuses you get at different levels, and they are both the same through either platform. Of course, notably, our producer level gets a pin, the legacy partner gets everything else that everybody gets, but also, we're going to work together, and we are going to direct an episode annually. Again, if you want to know more, head on over to the website and check us out there. Next up, very quickly, let's talk about where there's going to be some presentations. If you're listening to this on the 7th of March, I will have just presented in the last few days for Bloomington number 43 here in Illinois via Zoom on its business time. And of course, the new book, How to Charter a Lodge, a No-Nonsense, Unsanctioned Guide. And I'll have presented that with Brother John Ruark, my co-author of It's Business Time, and I'm sure it was amazing. Then we will be in attendance at MasonicCon up at Ezekiel Bates come May 1st. So stay tuned for details. You're going to want to check out MasonicCon and Ezekiel Bates on Facebook and check out everything they have to offer. EsoterraCon is also coming up shortly after MasonicCon at Ezekiel Bates. I have seen some things. It looks to be very promising, and the schedule of speakers this year is not short of amazing. Let me tell you that. Some news on Wilmshurst University. We broke the news last week and talked a little bit about it. It is coming. We have 5 classes that look to be launching here around June 21st. I want to let everybody know who has some concerns that were voiced on Reddit, right? I think I talked a little bit about that last week, but really what's exciting here is that we are addressing those concerns, and the people who are going to be teaching these classes aren't like your hokey, weirdo people that a lot of our academics are like, whoa, what are you doing here with some of these topics? These are all really responsible and researched and practical topics. And of course, we will have some topics that are not for everybody. And whether those topics that are not for everybody includes the concepts and history of geometry, or maybe that's practical tarot or data-driven demographics for membership. I mean, who knows? But I will tell you that the courses we are planning for launch are really amazing. And we've got teachers that span the gamut. Renowned national speakers, past grandmasters even, have signed up to facilitate classes. So I hope to see you. If you want to know more about Wilmshurst University, you can head on over to wilmshurstuniversity.com, scroll down a little bit, and you'll see a sign up for announcements. This is a MailChimp sign up form, so email, address, first name, last name, subscribe. And when we are ready to launch and get some news up, you'll be the first to know when we email all of those people out first. I want to thank everybody out there who has bought or left a review for The Master's Word, a short treatise on the Word, the Light, and the Self. The print book is autographed and available through wcypodcast.com, but is also available on Amazon and Kindle as well. I initially had a short run of author copies sent to my house here so that we could facilitate these autographed versions, but they sold out, like, really fast. So I already have ordered more, and the folks who are still waiting to get their copies, I want to let you know that the copies are on order, and as soon as they come in, I will sign them and get them in the mail and ship them right away so you won't have to wait around for them. Although I did hear from some of you that you already have quite the reading list, and it's no big deal to wait an extra couple days. So to you all, I thank you very much, and to anybody else out there who's just exhibited some extraordinary amount of patience as we get these books in and sent off, I thank you very much also. Want to know more about it? Again, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on the shop, and you can check it out. And last bit of news before we move into this week's education is, of course, Southern California Research Lodge. Their magazine, The Fraternal Review, did an entire episode on the Masonic Legacy Society. I was the guest editor, so I was able to work with some amazing authors, some real heavy hitters, on curated content that is sure to edify your mind. If you want to know more about the Masonic Legacy Society, the first thing you could do is, of course, head on over to the website, MasonicLegacySociety.com, or go to our website and find it under Other Projects. Now, I will also say the podcast for that particular episode, for that particular issue of the Fraternal Review, is out or should be out right now, and I was interviewed by Brother Ian from the Fraternal Review, and I want to extend a hearty thank you to Brother Ian for his professionalism and his questions. With that, let's dig right in. Last time, we finished up part one with chapter number 6. Now we're moving into part two of Max Heindel's Ancient and Modern Initiation. So, here we go. Part two, chapter 1, The Annunciation and Immaculate Conception. Much is said in certain classes of the Western world about initiation. This, in the minds of most people, seems usually to be associated with the occultism taught in the religious of the Far East, something that is peculiar to the devotees of Buddhism, Hinduism, and kindred systems of faith, and which in no way appertains to the religion of the Western world, particularly to the Christian religion. We have shown in the preceding series on symbols and ancient and modern initiation that this idea is entirely gratuitous, and that the ancient tabernacle in the wilderness pictures in its symbolism the path of progression from childlike ignorance to superhuman knowledge. As the Vedas brought light to the devotees who worshipped in faith and fervor on the banks of the Ganges in the sunny south, so the Eddas were a guiding star to the sons of the rugged Northland, who sought the light of life in ancient Iceland, where the sturdy Vikings steered their ships in frozen seas. Arjuna, who fights the noble fight in the Mahabharata, or Great War, constantly being waged between the higher and lower self, difference in no ways from the hero of the northern soul myth, Siegfried, which means he who through victory gains peace. Both are representative of the candidate undergoing initiation, and though their experiences in this great adventure vary in certain respects called for by the temperamental differences of the northern and southern peoples, and provided for in the respective schools to which they are referred for soul growth, the main features are identical, and the end, which is enlightenment, is the same. Aspiring souls have walked to the light in the brilliantly illuminated Persian temples where the sun god in his blazing chariot was the symbol of light, and well as under the mystic magnificence of the iridescence shed abroad by the aurora borealis of the frozen north, that the true light of the deepest esoteric knowledge has always been present in all ages. Even the darkest of the so-called dark, there is ample evidence to show. Raphael used his wonderful skill with the brush to embody it in two of his great paintings, the Sistine Madonna and the Marriage of the Virgin, which we would advise the interested reader to examine for himself. Copies of these paintings are procurable in almost any art store. In the original, there is a peculiar tint of golden haze behind the Madonna and Child, which, though exceedingly crude to one gifted with spiritual sight, is nevertheless as close an imitation of the basic color of the first heaven world as it is possible to make with pigments of earth. Close inspection of this background will reveal the fact that it is composed of a multitude of what we are used to call angel heads and wings. This again is as literal a pictorial representation of facts concerning the inhabitants of that world as could be given. For during the process of purgation, which takes place in the lower regions of the desire world, the lower parts of the body are actually disintegrated so that only the head, containing the intelligence of man, remains when he enters the first heaven, a fact which has puzzled many who have happened to see the souls there. The wings, of course, have no reality outside the picture, but were placed there to show ability to move swiftly, which is inherent in all beings in the invisible worlds. The people is represented as pointing to the Madonna and the Christ child, and a close examination of the hand wherewith he points will show that it has six fingers. There is not historical evidence to show that the pontiff actually had such a deformity, neither can that fact be an accident. The six fingers in the painting must therefore have been due to design on the part of the painter. What its purpose was, we shall learn by examination of the Marriage of the Virgin, where a similar anomaly may be noted. In that picture, Mary and Joseph are represented together with the Christ child under such conditions that it is evident that they are just on the eve of departure for Egypt, and a rabbi is in the act of joining them in wedlock. The left foot of Joseph is the foremost object in the picture, and if we count, we shall find it represented as having six toes. By the six fingers in the Pope's picture and the six toes of Joseph, Raphael wants to show us that both possess a sixth sense, such as is awakened by initiation. By this subtle sense, the foot of Joseph was guided in its flight to keep secure that sacred things which had been entrusted to his care. The other was given a sixth sense, that he might not be a blind leader of the blind, but might have the seeing eye required to point out the way, the truth, and the life. And it is a fact, though not commonly known, that, with one or two exceptions, when political power was strong enough to corrupt the College of Cardinals, all who have sat upon the so-called throne of Peter have had the spiritual sight in a greater or lesser degree. We have seen in the articles on symbolism of ancient and modern initiation, which preceded the present article, that the Atlantean mystery temple known as the Tabernacle in the Wilderness was a school of soul growth, and it should not surprise us to learn that the four Gospels containing the life of Christ are also formulae of initiation, revealing another and a later path to power. In the ancient Egyptian mysteries, Horus was the first fruit, whom the aspirant endeavored to imitate, and it is significant that in the ritual of initiation, which was in vogue in that day, and which we now call the Book of the Dead, the aspirant to initiation was always addressed Horus so-and-so. Following the same method today, we might appropriately address those following the Christian path of initiation as Christ so-and-so. For as a matter of fact, all who tread this path are really Christs in the making. Each in his or her turn will reach the different stations of the Via Dolorosa, or Path of Sorrow, which leads to Calvary, and experience in his or her own body the pangs and pains suffered by the hero of the Gospels. Initiation is a cosmic process of enlightenment and evolution of power, therefore the experiences of all are similar in their main features. The Christian mystic form of initiation differs radically from the Rosicrucian method, which aims to bring the candidate to compassion through the knowledge, and therefore seeks to cultivate in him the latent faculties of spiritual sight and hearing at the very start of his career as an aspirant to the higher life. It teaches him to know the hidden mysteries of being and to perceive intellectually the unity of each with all, so that at last, through this knowledge, there is awakened within him the feeling that makes him truly realize his oneness with all that lives and moves, which puts him in full and perfect tune with the infinite, making him a true helper and worker in the divine kingdom of evolution. The goal attained through Christian mystic initiation is the same, but the method, as said, is entirely different. In the first place, the candidate is usually unconscious of trying to attain any definite object, at least during the first stages of his endeavors, and there is in this noble school of initiation, but no teacher, the Christ, who is ever before the spiritual vision of the candidate as the ideal and the goal of all of his striving. The Western world, alas, has become so enmeshed in intellectuality that its aspirants can only enter the path when their reason has been satisfied, and unfortunately, it is a desire for more knowledge which brings most of its pupils to the Rosicrucian school. It is an arduous task to cultivate in them the compassion which must blend with their knowledge and be the guiding factor in the use of it before they are fitted to enter the kingdom of Christ. But those who are drawn to the Christian mystic path feel no difficulty of that nature. They have within themselves an all-embracing love which urges them onward and eventually generates in them a knowledge which the writer believes to be far superior to that attained by any other method. One who follows the intellectual path of development is apt to sneer superciliously at another whose temperament impels him along the mystic path. Such an attitude of mind is not only detrimental to the spiritual development of whoever entertains it, but it is entirely gratuitous, as the works of Jacob Boehm, Thomas A. Kempis, and many others who have followed the mystic path will show. The more knowledge we possess, the greater condemnation also shall we merit if we do not use it right. But love, which is the basic principle in the Christian mystic life, can never bring us into condemnation or conflict with its purposes of God. It is infinitely better to be able to feel any noble emotion than to have the keenest intellect, and one which is able to define all emotions. Hair-splitting over the constitution and evolution of the atom surely will not promote soul growth as much as humble helpfulness toward our neighbor. There are 9 definite steps in Christian mystic initiation, commencing with the baptism, which is dedicatory. The Annunciation and Immaculate Conception proceeds as matters of course for reasons given later. Having prepared our minds for the foregoing consideration, we are now ready to consider each stage separately in this glorious process of spiritual unfoldment. The Annunciation and Immaculate Conception. The Christian mystic is emphatically not the product of one life, but the flower of many preparatory existences, during which he has cultivated that sublime compassion which makes him feel the whole world's woe and conjures up before his spiritual vision the Christ ideal as the true balm of Gilead, its practice the only palladium against all human grief and sorrow. Such a soul is watched over special care by the divine hierarchies who have charge of our progression along the path of evolution, and when the time is ripe for him to enter that life in which he is to run the final race to reach the goal and become a savior of his kind, angels are indeed watching, waiting, and singing hosannas in joyful anticipation of that great event. Like always seeks like, and naturally the parents are carefully selected for, and by such a noble soul from among the sons and daughters of the king, they may be in the poorest circumstances from a worldly point of view. It may be necessary to cradle the babe in a manger, but no richer gift ever came to parents than such a noble soul. Among the qualifications necessary to be the parents of such an ego is that the mother be a virgin and the father be a builder. It is stated in the Bible that Joseph was a carpenter, but the Greek word is tekton, which means builder. In mystic masonry, God is called the great architect. Arche is the Greek word for signifying primordial substance, and a tekton is a builder. Thus God is the great master builder who, out of primordial substance, fashioned the world as an evolutionary field for various grades of beings. He uses in his universe many tektons or builders of various grades. Everyone who follows the path of spiritual attainment, endeavoring to work constructively with the laws of nature as a servant of humanity, is a tekton, or builder in the sense that he has the qualifications necessary to aid in giving birth to a great soul. Thus, when it is said that Jesus was a carpenter and the son of a carpenter, we understand that they were both tektons or builders along cosmic lines. The Immaculate Conception, like all other sublime mysteries, has been dragged down into the gutter of materiality, and being so sublimely spiritual, it has perhaps suffered more by this rude treatment than any other of the spiritual teachings. Perhaps it has suffered even more from the clumsy explanation of ignorant supporters than from the jeers and sneers of the cynic. The doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, as popularly understood, is that about 2,000 years ago, God, in a miraculous manner, fertilized a certain Mary, who was a virgin. As the result, she gave birth to Jesus, an individual who is, consequence, was the Son of God, in a sense different from all other men. There is also, in the popular mind, the idea that this incident is unique in the history of the world. It is particularly the latter fallacy which has served to distort the beautiful spiritual truth concerning the Immaculate Conception. It is not unique in any sense. Every great soul who has been born into the world to live a life of sublime saintliness, such as required for the Christian mystic initiation, has also found entrance through of immaculate virginity, who were not besmirched by passion in the performance of the generative act. Men do not gather grapes of thorns. It is an axiomatic truth that like begets like. And before anyone can become a savior, he must himself be pure and sinless. He being pure cannot take birth from one who is vile. He must be born of virgin parents. But the virginity to which we refer does not comprehend a merely physical condition. There is not inherent virtue in physical virginity, for all possesses it at the beginning of life, no matter how vile their disposition may be. The virginity of the mother of the Savior is a quality of the soul, which remains unsullied regardless of the physical act of fertilization. When people perform the first creative act without desire for offspring, merely for gratification of their animal lusts and propensities, they lose the only physical virginity they ever possessed. But when prospective parents unite in a spirit of prayer, offering their bodies upon the altar of sacrifice in order to provide an incoming soul with the physical body needed at the present time to further spiritual development, their purity of purposes preserves their virginity and draws a noble soul to their hearth and home. Whether a child is conceived in sin or immaculately depends upon its own inherent soul quality, for that will unerringly draw it to parents of a nature like unto its own. To become the son of a virgin predicates a past career of spirituality for the one who is so born. The mystic birth of a builder is a cosmic event of great importance. And it is therefore not surprising that it is pictured in the skies from year to year, showing a graphic symbolism in the great world or macrocosm, what will eventually take place in man, the little world or microcosm. We are all destined to experience the things that Jesus experienced, including the Immaculate Conception, which is a prerequisite to the life of saints and saviors of varying degrees. By understanding this great cosmic symbol, we shall more easily understand its application to the individual human being. The sun is the light of the world in a material sense. When in wintertime it reaches the extreme southern declination at the solstice on December 23rd, the people in the northern hemisphere, where all the present religions have had their birth, are plunged into the deepest, darkest, and bereft of all sustaining vital power emanating from the sun, which is then partly dead so far as its influence upon men is concerned. It is therefore necessary that a new light shine in the darkness, that a son of good be born to save humanity from the cold and famine which must inevitably result if the sun were to remain in the southern position which he occupies at the winter solstice. On the night between the 24th and 25th of December, the sun having commenced to slowly rise toward the Earth's equator, the zodiacal sign of Virgo, the Immaculate Celestial Virgin, is on the eastern horizon in all northern latitudes in the hours immediately preceding midnight. In the science of astrology, it is the sign and degree on the eastern horizon at the time of birth which determine the form or body of the creature then born. Therefore, the Son of Good is said to have been born of Virgo, the sublime celestial virgin who remains as pure after giving birth to her son child as she was before. By analogy, the Son of God, who comes to save his fellow men, must also be born of an immaculate spiritual virgin. From what has been said, it is evident that a great period of preparation precedes the entrance of a Christian mystic into the present sphere of human life. Though he, in his physical consciousness, is usually entirely unaware of the fact of the great adventure in store for him, in all probability his childhood days and early youth will pass in obscurity while he lives an inner life of unusual depth, unconsciously preparing himself for the baptism, which is the first of the 9 steps of this method of attainment. Well, there you have Chapter 1 of Part 2, Ancient and Modern Initiation by Max Heindel. Here in this chapter is very interesting. The New Age Christian doctrine is somewhat exposed here, addressing both the ideas of the Builder and the Immaculate Virgin. And there's been a lot of conjecture most recently, historically, in regards to historical context about the word virgin as it's been translated. If you listen to our episode last week when we talked to Brother Joe Martinez, he studies these biblical languages, the things that the Gospels were originally written in. And it's been said also that virgin in these terms, through a series of mistranslations doesn't actually mean the physical virgin either. It means a young lady only. And so in this sense, it would be supposed that Jesus' parents had lain together. And this was a very interesting piece of historical and contextual information when I originally read about it as well. But here, it refers to a spiritual purity of soul. For our Craftsman Plus out there, given the various traditions at large here, kind of amalgamated into this New Age thought in the Immaculate Conception in all people and this kind of thing, is there a more dynamic or underlying truth that pervades all three of these systems? And I say three, but there could be more. Go ahead and leave your thoughts on the topic, if you feel comfortable, in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. Next up, let's check out this Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison.
Karl Braun, born in 1850 in Fulda, Germany, was educated at the University of Berlin, graduating with a Ph.D. in physics. In 1897, he built the first cathode ray tube, more commonly known today as a CRT, which became the seminal tool for developing television and computer terminals. He also discovered and patented a method of transmitting a directional signal that eventually led to the development of radar and other innovations in radio and television technology. In 1909, he shared the Nobel Prize in Physics with Marconi for that work. He was revered in his native country as a true pioneer in electronics. In 1959, when his hometown of Fulda opened a new school building, they named it the Carl Ferdinand Braun High School. However, prior to its opening, some local citizens discovered Braun was a Freemason. With that, they demanded a different name for the school. Wanting to avoid a dispute, City Fathers abandoned the plan to name the school after their native son and began a search for a new honoree. After their lengthy search, a committee recommended Heinrich Friedrich Karl von Stein, a 19th century Prussian statesman. Von Stein developed an early distaste for the pettiness of diplomacy and went to England to research commerce and mining. In 1795, he was appointed president of the Westphalian Chambers, which dealt with commercial mining in Prussia. In 1804, he was appointed trade minister, where he introduced reforms that streamlined the nation's trade. His reforms were not universally popular, however. He pushed hard for additional reforms in letters to Prussian King William Frederick III, who became irritated and eventually dismissed Stein as an insolent, obstinate, and disobedient official. While the king was busy being distracted by his irritabilities, Napoleon overran the country. When Napoleon suggested Stein for the office of foreign minister, William, still the king, had no choice but to appoint him. With the king functioning as a figurehead, this gave Stein immense power. He began implementing reforms and issued an edict of emancipation which abolished serfdom throughout the country. When Stein, however, called for a national uprising in Germany, Napoleon turned against him and forced Stein into exile. There, he eventually aligned with Russia. When the Russians defeated Napoleon, Stein was able to return to Prussia as administrator of the liberated territory, where he continued to press for reform until his death in 1831 at the age of 73. With a resume like that, it was an easy decision to honor Stein by naming the school after him and kicked the dreaded Freemason Karl Braun to the curb. Today, the Stein School in Fulda has grown into a large campus consisting of a high school, middle school, and gymnasium for the entire community, the same one that rejected Braun because of his Masonic ties. Well, that's the way it goes sometimes. There is, however, an epilogue to this account. Upon further research, we find that Braun, although a brilliant and productive scientist, was never a Freemason. What's more, a little digging has turned up the fact that Stein was, in fact, a Freemason. That's right, Brother Heinrich Frederick Carl von Stein was a member of Joseph of the Three Helmets Lodge at Wetzlar, Germany. Karma. I'm not really sure how you define it, but I know it when I see it. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
Well, how about that for karma? Isn't that crazy? You know, at the end of this, I thought for sure that perhaps Stein was going to say to hell with this and rename the school after the Freemason. That didn't happen. Instead, it remained under his name, and we find out that he's a Mason. Crazy stuff. Our thanks goes out to illustrious Brother Steve for his continued efforts in bringing us these amazing segments to tell us these truly, believe it or not, things that happen within our craft. If you like these as much as I do, then you need to go over to our YouTube channel right there and check out all of the videos that illustrious Brother Steve puts together for us and gives you a little bit of vision to go with the story. Additionally, you can pick up the book Tales from the Craft right there in the bookstore on the WCYpodcast.com. So you can click on bookstore and you'll see a list of books that are by people who have come on the show, including all of Steve's books right there. I invite you to check those out. Now this week is kind of a double whammy because I really wanted to read this one piece that was recently released on the Midnight Freemasons, and it comes from Brother Stephen L. Harrison as well. And I really liked this piece, and I thought it was a great example of virtue. So here we go. A Profile in Courage by Midnight Freemason contributor Brother Stephen L. Harrison, 33rd Degree, FMLR. Author's note. This is in no way meant to be a political post. It is an account of events that occurred nearly half a century ago with no intent to imply any relationship to events today. The 1956 Pulitzer Prize-winning book Profiles in Courage is a series of biographies of eight U.S. state senators who endured criticism and personal loss after unpopular acts they each thought were the right thing to do. Among those accounts are courageous votes of Masonic brothers Thomas Hart Benton and Sam Houston, both of whom opposed extending slavery into the U.S. territories and subsequently lost elections because of their actions. Such politicians taking action against the majority views of their constituents in spite of the consequences are a rare breed. Another of our Masonic brothers, Gerald Ford, falls into that category. Living in an intensely divided nation today, it is hard to imagine a time when the mood of the country, short of the Civil War era, may have been more politically separated or rancorous. But the Vietnam Watergate era of the early mid-1970s clearly qualifies for that. In 1968, Richard Nixon, after losing a close presidential race to John Kennedy in 1960, made the political comeback of the century. He won the presidency with a promise to end the unpopular Vietnam War. Instead, he expanded the war, even taking it into countries neighboring Vietnam. With those actions, war protests, which had been going on for years, hit a new level of intensity. At the same time, Nixon's acerbic vice president, Spiro T. Agnew, who himself had been intensifying the divisions in the country, came under fire for corrupt practices while governor of Maryland. After a two-year acrimonious battle, Agnew pleaded nolo contendere to felony tax evasion, was fined, and placed on probation. With that, Agnew resigned from the vice presidency, and President Nixon selected longtime Republican Congressman Gerald Ford to succeed him. With all that going on, the 1972 presidential election saw Nixon's re-election, subsequently his involvement in and cover-up of the 1972 break-in at the Democratic headquarters gradually came to light in what has now become known as the Watergate Affair. So, with the Vietnam War in full swing, war protests raging, the vice president battling accusations of corruption and Watergate grinding on, the U.S. went through a 3-year period of political meltdown. Nixon's involvement in Watergate, his lies, and attempts to cover up his actions finally brought him down. Leaders of his own party convinced him there was sufficient votes in both houses of Congress to impeach and convict, leading him to resign the presidency before that happened. Brother Ford took office on August 9, 1974. Ford took charge in the midst of all the political turmoil, wanting to put it in the past. Some of his first words to the country were, "Our national nightmare is over." But it wasn't. The country would now have to turn its attention to a laundry list of charges being brought against former President Nixon. The aftermath of his actions could have lasted for months, possibly years. Through indictments, trials, endless rehashing of events, and a plethora of incessant and merciless windbags debating it all, Ford saw it as his responsibility to end the turmoil and get the nation back to some semblance of normalcy. With that, he granted Richard Nixon a full, free, and absolute pardon. Political opponents and even members of Ford's Republican Party leveled a firestorm of criticism at the new president. They accused him, among other things, of making a deal with Nixon that would lead to Ford becoming president. That was not the case. The only deal Ford made was that Nixon had to admit guilt. Nixon accepted the pardon and withdrew to his home in San Clemente, removing himself from further involvement in the political arena. Historians agree Brother Ford's decision to pardon Richard Nixon was one of the main reasons contributing to the fact that he lost the 1976 presidential election to Jimmy Carter. Ford simply said he knew the aftermath of Nixon's actions could go on, and he knew he was the only one who could end it. John Kennedy, along with Ted Sorensen, wrote profiles in Courage. Had they written it today, they might have included more than senators, and they may well have included Gerald Ford. In fact, in a sense, he was included. In 1989, the Kennedy family established the Profiles in Courage Award in order to recognize the kind of political courage emphasized in the book. Then, in 2001, they named Ford the recipient of the honor for his courage in making a controversial decision of conscience to pardon former President Richard M. Nixon. Brother Gerald Ford, 33rd degree, was a member of Malta Lodge, number 465, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Stephen L. Harrison. Second question for a Craftsman Plus. Without getting into a political debate, throw the parties aside. What do you think about Brother Gerald Ford's decision? If you were placed in a similar situation, politics aside, what would you have done if you had an opportunity to stop this kind of arguing that was going on and move the country forward? Once more, I want to thank all of our contributors, our fellows, our producers, and legacy partners of the Whence Came You podcast. I hope you've all enjoyed this episode, and I want to invite you to come on back next week because I've got a special guest coming on the program, and we're going to talk a little bit about a new book, a little book called The Master's Word. That's right, I'll have Brother John Ruark on the program, and he and I are going to have a candid conversation about this book and all things that it contains within. We'll talk about why we enjoy Plumer's work, why we thought we should have this particular conversation, and why it was important to reissue the book. That's it. I hope you all have a wonderful week coming up. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.